I'm usually not accused of being the quiet one in the room, so see what we can do. So my name is Logan. I work with Driscoll's. I'm a recruiter for the R&D group, the global group that that we have of our research scientists. We hire a variety of disciplines in our research work, all supporting strawberry, raspberry, blackberry, and blueberry production. So I'll give a little brief background if you don't know about Driscoll's or who we are, and then I'll try to talk a little bit about some of the opportunities that we would have and maybe a little information on why. So our story really began in the late 1800s and 1900s in California, and really our focus is now pursuing flavor in all of our varieties, and that is consumer-driven focus, and it really ties into a lot of what we do in a variety of functions within our company. Driscoll's is family-owned, been around for over 100 years. We have our berry patch, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and blueberries. We sell berries all over the world. We have berry patches, what we would call them, on six different continents. And then essentially our goal is bringing that taste of summer year-round to consumers worldwide. So there is a difference in Driscoll's berries. You've had them personally, but we naturally breed our proprietary varieties. Most of the varieties that we grow or our growers have are proprietary. There are some exceptions with blueberries and blackberries, but our breeding programs are rapidly closing in on 100% proprietary varieties for those as well. We do raise and breed organic and conventional varieties, and our growers, depending on where they're at, will grow those accordingly. We definitely invest in technology and try to employ technology within our groups, but we do not use genetic modification in our breeding programs. It's all natural selection. So you can imagine it's thousands and thousands of varieties looked at each year. We do use molecular techniques and are trying to build up that program for the varieties we have. Then we have a sensory or consumer lab, which really is focused on tying in flavors or aromatics or traits that consumers would appreciate or not, and incorporate those back into our breeding programs. We have been known for supply chain solutions as well. Part of those would be our cold chain of really getting fruit cold quickly and keeping it there, and then keeping it all the way to the retailers, which is essential for berries to be in a good condition when you buy them. And then traceability. So we have traceability back to farms. We know individual trucks. If you were at our corporate offices, we actually have screens bigger than that on the wall with maps, and you'll look and there'll be 200 dots around the country. We know if a truck has a door open, if it's moving, if it's closed, if a temperature sensor's off. Every one of those trucks, we know where it's at and what it's doing. We can call drivers and tell them to check their temperature if we need to, and that's super important. Without that, you can end up with a truckload of $100,000 juice at your retailer. So how we grow. So we do partner with independent growers, and they grow our proprietary varieties around the world. So Driscoll's is the biggest seller of fruit, but we don't actually grow anything for fruit production. We do use different growing systems depending on the region. Soil grown is typical of what you'll find in the United States and in elsewhere in the world. But substrate and even tabletop strawberry production is something that we're moving towards worldwide, really focused on California, Mexico at this point, and growing out that technique. That's actually a part of what we're looking for in experience levels for new employees coming in, especially ones that are dealing with our growers and helping to advise them. Our nursery, which we own and operate our own nurseries and tissue culture labs. We just built a brand new tissue culture lab in Puebla, Mexico. That's a pretty exciting endeavor and really gives us our ability to have control over that plant material, ensuring the genetic uniformity, and then our clean stock program. We do ship plants all over the world, so we work closely with just the government agencies to make sure that what we're sending is disease-free, it's true to type, then our molecular groups and other scientists help support that work too. We do provide the proprietary seedlings to our growers at the planting time, and that's kind of the model there. Depending on geographic location, that's a lot of work in planning, just what we're going to be harvesting or what we're what we'd love to harvest. I guess we're definitely a weather-dependent company, but we do have plans based on our consumer demand, on where we need to grow, how much, and what varieties we want to target. And we develop that information through our breeding programs and data collection, so we have a good understanding of what varieties will do in different areas, different locations, how they're treated, how they're grown. We have times like this year where weather was very cooperative with California strawberry growers, meaning there was a ton of fruit and really not good prices for us, but consumers could get the buy one, get two free sort of scenarios. So weather changes, and each year is a little bit different. We do focus on global food safety, worker welfare, and sustainability. It's part of our responsibility as a company to ensure that our growers are acting accordingly. We have in the past kind of raised the bar on what local standards may allow to ensure that we have really consistency in how our farmers are using labor and how they treat workers and how the workers are able to really grow within those companies. The food safety piece really is kind of covered through that here. Let's see. And Driscoll's is known as a company for being innovative back in the 40s. And so keep in mind, they started really in the early 1900s. So things started getting a little bit bigger. There was a foundation of the Strawberry Institute, and there's a lot of history about the where that came from and where it developed into. But it really was a program dedicated to research and breeding. In the 50s, it was the first patented strawberry by Driscoll's or that group. And then what it allowed for was increased production, longer seasons of growing, and then greater shipping ability, I guess. 70s, our independent growers all started shipping under one label. So now they were having Driscoll's fruit as opposed to three or four different brands that were out there at the time. In 1980s, we moved into packaging innovation. So Driscoll started selling, and then I was around, maybe a lot of you guys weren't, a yellow basket that people used to buy berries in. Maybe familiar older days with the green baskets of strawberries kind of loose in there. We had a yellow one. It was unique, a D on it for Driscoll's, and that kind of became part of the labeling of what Driscoll's was. People looked for this yellow basket. There's stories of 1990s of really the clamshell. That clamshell was developed through Driscoll's and through other some partners in there, and really revolutionized the packaging of berries, and it's translated to a lot of different food crops today. But that was part of what Driscoll's was able to offer that industry. In '90s, we also entered in the European market as well as began organic production. So today's challenges because of the changes in a lot of it is harvest labor and challenges with being able to afford our growers remaining in business. We have a variety of things we're focusing on, and mainly it is rising costs, which everybody is being affected with. Demand for organic products is also included in there. And then really consumers are demanding transparency in production. They want to know where their food's coming from, how it's being treated, how the workers are being treated, and we live in a world where in 5 minutes you can have something go viral and everyone sees it. So you really want to be a leader in the space and be take the high road when you need to and can. Our growing populations do demand a growing quality of the fruit as well. So everyone wants to buy the best perfect fruit always. They don't want to take anything with blemishes, and that makes it challenging for growers. So we want to reduce waste, but sometimes you have good fruit that that could go somewhere but may not look right. So there's challenges on that side of it. Substrate berry production is a big one for us. It's really a new one for U.S. markets. It is how a lot of our growers are growing elsewhere. And essentially, for us, substrate is coconut fiber bags on a bench top. So we're having soil-grown strawberry growers convert into a bench top growing system. The difference, and I don't know how many people have ever picked strawberries on a bed on the ground. It's hard. It's a lot of work, and it's very difficult. So what we find is the workers of harvesters, the population is getting older and older. It's a lot harder to get aging population back to pick strawberries. They'll come pick blueberries, they'll pick raspberries, they'll pick blackberries because they're standing up. If we can get strawberries off the ground, it helps alleviate that. By going into substrate, we also have better efficiency with water and fertilization, and then our nutrient management. So we can be a lot more direct, more hydroponic sort of greenhouse growing, although we're not building greenhouses. And then automation and technology, robotics and automation and harvesting. We are not building robots, but we are partnering with people who do. And that's pretty cool. It's interesting to see that. And it could be simple cart, and I have a couple pictures on the next couple slides here of some of those. And then really extending some of these partnerships across historical boundaries. Tabletop strawberries, I have a picture of one of our test plot areas in California. It's, the model is one of our marketing people, so she happened to Instagram photo, I stole it off there this morning. But our substrate-grown berries, more labor-friendly, more resource-friendly. They do require expertise and training, which a lot of people don't have today. I've been advised that any of our grower-facing agronomists that we're hiring, they need this experience. So we are very selective at who we're hiring in these roles, especially the ones that are in advisement sort of functions. And then automatic irrigation fertilization system. So essentially greenhouse controls and that sort of systems are being applied in field settings. So the technology is a lot different than what our growers are used to today, and it requires expertise on our side to help make them successful. Reason I mentioned some of these things, if you're in school and you have the ability to take some courses or to learn something new, try a project, those things are very relevant for our industry as a whole, not just Driscoll's, but the berry industry in general is changing. These are skills that are not going to go unnoticed. And then remote monitoring. So, you know, as we have fields, there was a story I saw on LinkedIn from one of our agronomists, posted a picture of himself on Sunday, and I said, hey, we don't work on Sunday, so don't go sharing that one around. But he was excited about the crop. Got an email on his phone that there was an issue with irrigation. So he's literally in a suit after church walking into the field to go check it. And he's like, you know, I love it. This is what I do, and I'm passionate about it. So it wasn't work for him. It was just checking his crop. Robotics and harvesting. I had a cool video, but I didn't know how the internet would work in here. But there's a company called Agrobot out of Spain. Some agriculture engineers that have developed a strawberry harvesting machine. Really, asked some of our growers, and this is kind of this crossing the boundaries, to see if they would be willing to partner and test this out. Unfortunately, our California growers weren't really interested in the experimentation, so we went out to some competitors, and we partnered with them to really look at how's this going to work, because this is an industry challenge, industry problem, not just Driscoll's. So we have these machines running in Southern California, more of a research sort of a test. But pretty cool, and you can really run a pretty efficient harvesting operation with minimal labor. And our goal is not to replace people. There's not enough people to do the work. So we have to do something else to be able to compete with, to be able to meet demands. This one, I think I did get a little chance to get some video on here, but this is another gentleman out of the California area that promotes this product, but it's a cart, just follows workers around. So not full automation harvesting, but if you can imagine, I would drive into work in the morning, and I'm coming in at around 8 o'clock, and there's literally people running from a field to a truck, back to the field to the truck, back, running with boxes, 8 in the morning. Come by at 5, they're still running all day long. Now, the workers make a lot of money if they can pick faster. Having a cart behind them that they can grab boxes and put the product on, that would save a lot of time if you just look at, like, lean principles. You know, running back and forth is what a waste. So something like that is pretty cost-effective. It's simple. It's not full automation, but it could help with what offset some of those challenges. And then analytics and data-driven decisions. Like most companies, we have a lot of data. We collect data from all aspects of what we do in human resources. You know, I get asked for data on how I do my job and how do I do my job better. Well, it's hard to really do things better if you don't know where you're at. and if you don't know what to improve on or where to improve on. So we do use analytics and data. It's funny, I was walking around looking at the job descriptions here. I think every one of them requires statistics. Every one of them. We're no different. So what do we do next, and how do we make those decisions? Those are all, in most cases, statistically driven decision making. And we do collect data in all areas of our business, not just in the production or the breeding side, which is a lot, but throughout our company, finance, our HR, as I mentioned, a lot of those areas. But we do have a need for expertise to really weed through that data and see the big picture. What do we need to make a decision on, and how are we going to do that? We need people that are well versed in being able to determine those kind of those next steps. So statistical analysis is very important in most of the roles that we hire for. I know with our last breeding positions that we've hired for, molecular backgrounds were required, and then also strong data analysis and statistical experience. Plant breeding, our operations side, our human resources side, finance, we all use it. It's kind of the, you need to have it for pretty much any job these days. And so those courses, if you haven't taken them or not well versed in it, I'd sign up. And then really quickly, well, maybe not so quick, but how to become a member of Driscoll's. We do have our open positions posted on our career site. It's driscolls.com/about/careers. And then if you're on that site, there's some really cool company history, and there's some videos that were put out there really regarding our pursuit of flavor and our breeding programs and our sensory groups. They're short, 5 minutes. They're entertaining. They're professionally done and really worth a few minutes if you're interested. I would recommend, if you are qualified, to apply for those positions if you're interested. You do have to have the minimum requirements. We often hire well above the minimum requirements, so I'll put that out there. Most of our positions are very competitive, so it's frustrating when you meet the minimums and you get a no, but keep trying. I applied in 99 to get a job. I got a no. I came back, 15 years later, and I got a yes. So it is a competitive process. I would ask that if you are applying for a position with us, please include a cover letter. It's not required. That cover letter is one way that you can show a little bit about your personality. You can explain the why you want the job, why you're a good fit, what interests you, and you don't have to go into a lot of detail. In most positions or any applications, whether for us or not, do some research on the company you're applying for. If you understand what they value, like for us, Driscoll's values, three values: passion, humility, trustworthiness. If you relate to those and you can describe why, that really helps set you apart. We have multiple applications from people, and a lot of times people don't include the cover letter. I love reading the cover letters. I want to know who you are as a person and why you're interested in this role. Those things are oftentimes the difference on how people get noticed throughout, when it is competitive. And then what to expect with our processes. We are pretty thorough. We're not the quickest in hiring, so I'll be upfront about that. So have a little patience in there if you're applying for a position with us. We do have several recruiters on our team, and we have recruiters in different regions. In Mexico, we have a team of recruiters there, and in the Netherlands for European operations. Australia, New Zealand, China, some of those other areas that we do work in are a little smaller, and so our HR professionals do the recruiting instead of having dedicated recruiters like myself. Qualified applicants, and often it's the most qualified, they're contacted and usually interviews are set up with the recruiter. After that, we would set that person up with the hiring manager for an interview, typically over the phone. Hiring manager would select the top candidates, generally two or three people, and invite them to the facility where they'd be working at for in-person interviews. And we do panel interviews of cross-functional employees. So you get a chance, and it's a really good opportunity to get to know different people that you'd interact with. I'd say probably the best interviewer we've had, and this would be kind of the interview advice, came in knowing exactly, and we tell people who they're going to interview with. So there's no secrets. I don't want to hide anything from you. I don't want to blindside you. We'll tell you what we're going to interview you on, who you're going to talk to, what their titles are. The best guy I had ever interview, and I told him I was taking notes myself, knew everybody was by name when he walked in the door without ever meeting them, had questions for them based on their connection to his role. Now, he was a senior level guy and he understood what he did and what the other functions did. So an entry-level position or someone first out of school, I wouldn't necessarily expect that. But if you're interviewing other people in plant breeding and you're a plant breeder, you can probably guess what kind of questions they're going to have for you. Maybe it's just team related, but really come prepared to an interview with some questions, and we want to get to know you better, and that's how we're going to make a hiring decision. And we host those at work sites. So typically, a lot of our positions are West Coast, East Coast. We do have some positions in the middle of the country, not many, and then around the world, where, depending on where we're at. For our R&D and our scientific positions, you can almost guarantee you will be asked to have a presentation. A lot of our work is presented internally, sometimes externally to peers in industry, but data sharing, information sharing, it's a very important part of the research work that we do, either with our growers or internally. So that would be something to keep in mind. And then our finalists are contacted and offers are extended. There are a couple additional ways to join besides regular jobs. We do offer formal internships, and that's a good way to get known and get noticed. Our internship program does have some metrics tied to it, so we'll get back to that data again. We want to hire about 50% of our interns into full-time roles. So it can be a great way to get your foot in the door, and there's countless examples of people who were successfully hired through internship programs. So we usually post those in February, although we know that things are getting earlier and earlier. We have career fairs in the fall now. We're usually not prepared because of budgeting times. We need to make sure that we get approval for all of our headcount. But you can typically find all of our positions for internships posted in February. We have some basic requirements. We have an internship manager who actively recruits, goes around to different schools during that time. We have a requirement that you need to either be in school or within 6 months of graduation to qualify for an internship. And that's in school and it's all levels, bachelor's, master's, PhD level. We have internships for a variety of them. We do have some seasonal opportunities, I think, for this this group. It's going to be a lot more limited. We're usually, higher education will typically go internships or full-time roles. Seasonal, though, can be a way to get your foot in the door. A lot of it is extra hands to help with test plots and things like that. So, and then we have a job alert you can set up on our career site. So put your name, email, what you want to be alerted on, and when those jobs come up, you get an email. They're pretty broad, so it may say R&D, and you're a plant breeder, and you get a job for someone else. It may not be the right fit, but encourage you to share that through your networks to let others know. That's what I got. I'm out here for the week. If you guys have any questions, or I'm happy to answer any now.